It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. How nonprofits take responsibility for gender pay equity is the subject of a great debate taking place tomorrow night at Pittsburgh's 20th Century Club. It's a fundraiser for the 74% Initiative, which conducts research on women in the nonprofit sector. The project takes its name from the approximate amount of the dollar that women at Pittsburgh area nonprofits earn compared with men. April 14th, tomorrow, is the date that symbolically illustrates how far into a year a woman must work to earn the same amount made by a man in the previous year. At the event, a panel will debate whether nonprofits should make gender wage disparity a priority issue. I'm joined now in Studio A by Peggy Uten, Executive Director of the Bayer Center for Nonprofit Management at Robert Morris University, which is presenting the debate. And it's actually Peggy Morrison Uten. Peggy Morrison Uten, good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Paul. I'm delighted to be here.
Also with us is Daria Crawley. She's Associate Professor of Management at Robert Morris University. Daria Crawley, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul.
And we'd like to hear from you at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is esspgh@wesa.fm. And on Twitter at ESSPGH. Should nonprofits make gender wage disparity a priority issue? What are your thoughts and questions about gender pay equity? 412-246-2002, the number to call. Peggy Morrison Uten, explain what's happening in the nonprofit sector with pay equity.
We do a wage and benefits study every 2 years, Paul. We began it in the year 2002. In 2002, women who were leading similar-sized nonprofit organizations and had the same job title as a man made 67 cents on the dollar to a man in the same sort of a job. By our last one, which was 2014, women had progressed to 75 cents on the dollar, so some progress, but still woefully slow. And, you know, this is the social justice sector we're talking about. I mean, people get up every morning in nonprofits to see that the world is a better place, that people are fairly treated, and it has become galling to think that we care so much about the people we serve and seemingly not enough about the people who serve them. 74% of the workforce is women in southwestern Pennsylvania in nonprofits, as well as the 74 cents on the dollar.
So why, you know, what exactly is happening in the nonprofit sector with pay equity? What are we seeing exactly?
Well, the nonprofit sector is a very atomized sector, Paul. Most nonprofits have 10 or fewer employees. And so the whole matter of how HR in general, you name it, from the way benefits packages are constructed to the thinking about, paid leave, all sorts of things. In many cases, there's not much infrastructure that surrounds HR in nonprofits. 90% of nonprofits have 10 or fewer employees. In many cases, the bookkeeper keeps the list of vacation days, and that's about the extent of HR in the nonprofit. So the whole matter of doing really high-quality evaluation, looking at market value of jobs, all of that is not very well addressed because we're not funded to do that. So I believe pay equity and the lack of attention to HR matters is undergirding this whole issue. We just don't have much of a sense of being an employee in a nonprofit. The other piece of this is that pay scales for executives are set by boards of directors. And boards of directors have been recruited, and I've helped recruit literally thousands of members of boards of directors, and we recruit them by mission. And that's appropriate, Paul. I mean, we are there to serve the community. We are there to see that things are better. But we don't talk to them much about the fact that they are also an employer of people, and as an employer, they have certain responsibilities to those people to do a better job all the way around pay equity issues, around HR in general. So I have great concern for both older women. As a boomer myself, and boomers are turning 65 at the rate of 10,000 a day, a lot of women who have devoted their lives in service to the community are going to retire on very inadequate retirement provision. And I have very great concern for younger younger women, because older women aren't leaving their jobs very fast because they need to keep working because they need the money. And so, therefore, younger women and men are not being able to progress as rapidly as we would wish. And I want to say this is not just a woman's issue. This is a man's issue, too. When men work in industries that are female-dominated, 74% of the workforce is female, they don't make as much money either. So we're all in this together, and it's an issue for society because nonprofits undergird the humanity of our society and make us this a place we're all proud to live.
Daria Crawley, why does pay equity persist?
So some of the research has indicated, we talk about pay equity, and it talks about the jobs that women hold, the college degrees as a college professor. You know, am I going to go into engineering or English? Am I going to go into nursing or education, bioscience, et cetera? And the expectation is that if I'm a teacher, I'm simply just not paid as much. So women going into those fields, the expectation is that, well, you selected to be a school teacher, so you're just not paid as much as an engineer. But when we balance it out for degree, looking at men going into the same field, in the teaching fields and engineering fields, along with women beside them, women are still paid less. Now, another argument
in education?
In education, we find it in engineering, et cetera. So when they have the same college degrees, there's still this disparity that exists. Now, some people say, well, women simply don't negotiate well. But when we have taught women how to negotiate, the things to ask, how to do their job research about what's the competitive pay for the region that they're going in, et cetera, we still find that the equity exists. Some of the research that I've done with one of my colleagues from Robert Morris, Jill Maher, and another colleague, Stacey Blake Beard at Simmons College, looks at this idea that is called organizational citizenship behavior, which examines, you know, are you your willingness to do these things that are not compensated for, voluntary behavior. So, for example, Paul, we ask you, you know, will you talk to some high school students who are coming in and interested in broadcasting? Will you help out a colleague who's starting a new show? And you're like, sure, I'm doing it. It's not part of my necessary job. I'm not compensated for it, but I'm willing to do it. Our research indicates that women who are satisfied with their pay are much more likely to perform those organizational citizenship behaviors, which for me raises the question, imagine if all women were satisfied with their pay. Wouldn't they perform these behaviors more? Especially when we transfer it over to Peggy, thinking about these nonprofit institutions, organizational justice, where there's lots of opportunity for these OCBs, uncompensated behaviors. Imagine if we paid them equitably, what kind of work would we get out of them? And that's just a very business perspective, not thinking necessarily so much about the humanity side of it, but I could get more work out of you.
And I should say, you have been saying, and as have I, we're all guilty of this, we've been saying pay equity, but what we're really referring to is pay inequity.
Yes.
And
yes.
Why does it persist, and what problems does it create for society? And you touched on this a little bit earlier, Peggy Morrison Uten, you know, just certainly from a business standpoint, how it might impact business. And I think, Daria, you outlined that as well. So what about for society in general? What types of problems does pay inequity create?
Well, I think it creates inequities in terms of the idea of overall compensation for a family. So if you have two working members of the family, Peggy, you've talked about people starting to retire, and we think about our retirement income, imagine the deficit that we will have as a couple if your partner is a woman who simply hasn't been paid as much. So maybe I'm not able to buy that house on Martha's Vineyard or retire there or take trips or do things with my grandchildren or care for myself and my spouse when we have medical issues that come up simply because our retirement funds have not been maximized because we haven't been able to put the maximum amount in because we have not received that.
We have 300,000 people who work in nonprofits in southwestern Pennsylvania, Paul. So do the math. That's 225,000 women who are working in nonprofits. And many of them, there are nonprofits here who pay some of their line workers so poorly that they qualify for the benefits the nonprofit provides to poorer people. So this is a poverty eradication movement as well as a pay inequity movement. We are saying we want to see women throughout and we want to see men throughout. We want to see everyone be fairly compensated for a good job, a job well done. Now, if it isn't a job well done, I don't want to see them paid. I want to see them fired.
Exactly.
But if it is done well and people are working to be good citizens in their workplaces, Darius, then then it just seems right that if we are going to be promoting a world that works, which is really the basic job description, if you will, for the nonprofit sector, we should see people who are treated fairly inside. Men should be treated fairly. Women should be treated fairly. And it would go towards having a stronger economy because people in nonprofits are 300,000 workers in our region would have more to spend with other businesses and with and in the stores and restaurants. So this is a healthy thing. But the other thing that we need to be thoughtful about is college students and student debt and how we have had a deal where boomers and people coming behind them didn't have the same level of debt when they came out of school, so they could afford to work for a lower wage. So this is a complex issue that touches people of all ages and throughout society.
Is there anything to call this other than discrimination? And how does it persist? I know I brought this up earlier, but you know, we're talking about the 21st century and the idea that companies could pay men and women doing the same job at different levels of pay, higher for men, less than women, less for women, and as we cited earlier, 74 cents on the dollar. How do companies get away with this? And aren't there laws to prevent it?
Well, you know, let me talk to you about some of the research we've done at Robert Morris through the Polling Institute, because some people are surprised by this. I mean, isn't everybody paid equally now? You know, we did a survey last year of over 1,000 individuals, men and women, across the country. And some of the results that we have indicated that about 30% of all Americans that we surveyed indicated that they believe women in this country receive equal pay for equal work. Fewer than a quarter of Pennsylvanians agreed with this statement in terms of women receiving equal pay for equal work.
So fewer than a quarter of Pennsylvanians agreed that women are paid the same as a man.
Exactly.
So, but what you said earlier, if I'm following you correctly, was that there are not that many people who are aware that this is happening.
That's right. That's my kind of general idea and statement. So many individuals agree that employers believe that, you know, kind of thinking about it, you know, women don't need to be paid equally, that they can receive less income.
Well, these must be men.
I don't necessarily.
Really?
Not necessarily always men. Some women are also in there. Yeah. So what I want to say here is that, you know, if we could be paid equitably, as Peggy has already kind of mentioned here, imagine how we could give to our economy. You know, in this type of fiscal climate, when we need to keep our restaurants open, our small businesses open, et cetera, here we would now have people who might potentially have more disposable income, or if not even disposable income, in nonprofit sector, they wouldn't simply have to go work for the nonprofit and then also use the services of the nonprofit. So I would be able to meet my bills. I would be able to send my kids
to
college.
And this has to be especially acute for households only headed by women.
Exactly.
Because the number is on the increase, according to a Pew Research study.
Yes. But there's another factor in all of this, and I think it is about, once again, the way boards set salaries. So you're saying, how can this be true in companies? Nonprofits have 10 or fewer employees.
And the reason I'm asking this, Peggy, is that we have laws that prevent discrimination, that we have equal opportunity laws.
Yes.
On the books, in writing.
Yes.
So then how would a company, even a private company, you know, at the whim of the head of the board of directors, be able to decide based on sex that a woman doesn't need to be paid the same as a man, even if she's doing the same work and has the same qualifications?
Oh, I don't think it's nearly that overt, Paul. I mean, I don't think that they literally stand at a board meeting and say, she's a woman,
no,
we don't have to pay her as much.
But at some point, I mean, even if they're hiding the salaries from whoever, you know, has access to that, whether it's the board of directors, somebody knows what's going on.
Yes. But I don't think that much time or attention has been devoted to these issues. Again, HR, nonprofits are funded to deliver programs and services. They are an external force. That's where we put our – so I think –
Let me ask you this way.
Okay.
If you advertise a job, all right, and you're asking for all qualified candidates to apply – and the salary is set at a certain level, or, you know, the salary, a lot of times it's negotiable, but mm-hmm. but in certain positions, there is a specific salary structure in place. Does that then change if a woman gets the job?
It can. I just was talking to a search consultant last week who has told me over the years, often salaries are set by what the person was making at their former job. So on more than one occasion, she's been working with a nonprofit board. They have a stated salary.
It's a real
salary.
Treadmill, isn't it?
Yes.
You're making less because you're a woman on your previous job, so then you're just going to end up making less on the next one.
And so, and my friend who is a national search consultant has told me on more than one occasion that there was a stated salary. It was whatever it was, a salary range. And then the preferred candidate turned out to be a woman, and they found out that she made significantly less than the bottom of that salary range. And the board would start to say, well, we don't need to pay her as much as we have in the salary. And they think they're being frugal and fiscally responsible by doing that. They say, if we just give her a 10% bump off her current salary, that will acknowledge it. So it isn't that people are sitting there saying, she's a woman, we don't value her, but it is true that in nonprofits we're taught to be frugal and careful with other people's money, which is appropriate. But if a woman comes in and she has systematically been paid less, and all of the research shows that right out of school, women with MBAs make 7% less than young men with MBAs, and it gets worse as they get older. So if you're setting salaries on existing salaries, then you're never going to see real progress and to see this gap close.
It may not be overt, as you say, but it seems as though what's happening is that if a company, whether it's a for-profit or a nonprofit, if they can get away with it, they will. I don't mean to cut you off,
that's
Daria,
okay.
But we need to go to a break.
Okay.
So let me do that, and you'll be first up.
Thank you.
When we come back, we're talking about the issue of pay inequity with Peggy Morrison Uten, who is the executive director of the Bayer Center for Nonprofit Management at Robert Morris University, and Daria Crawley, who is associate professor of management at Robert Morris. And the great debate that's happening tomorrow night. We'll continue our great debate here in the studio. This is Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the issue of pay inequity. A recent Robert Morris University poll showing 60% of all respondents believe most employers view women as not needing pay that is equal to their male counterparts in the same positions. A majority of those polled also agreed that most employers hide salaries to avoid paying men and women equally. We're seeing that, according to figures, women are being paid in Pittsburgh only 74 cents on the dollar compared with what men are being paid. And there's a debate taking place tomorrow that we're previewing on the show today. Tomorrow is April 14th, which is the date that symbolically illustrates how far into a year a woman must work to earn the same amount made by a man in the previous year. You can join our conversation with our guests, Peggy Morrison Uten, Executive Director of the Bayer Center for Nonprofit Management at Robert Morris, as well as Daria Crawley, Associate Professor of Management at Robert Morris, at 412-246-2002. We'll go to the phones momentarily here, but just as we were going to the break, Daria Crawley, you were about to make a point, and I want to let you make that right now.
Thank you. So what I wanted to talk to you about was the Paycheck Fairness Act. This was an act that was put before the U.S. Senate and did not
pass. When did that happen?
Last fall. Did not pass. Had this act passed, it would have made it illegal for employers to retaliate against a worker who inquires about or discloses his or her wages to another employee in a complaint or an investigation. So remember before we were talking about, Peggy was sharing about in terms of a woman executive of a nonprofit salary. Well, she might not be able to do that salary comparison because at her previous employer, they might have made it illegal for her to do that. There might have been some form of retaliation. So there's this sense of pay secrecy going on that I don't want to ask you what you're paid because if I do, I might be retaliated against my employer. So simply, sometimes I do not know that the previous person in this position or somebody else was making $30,000 more than I am for doing the same work. I think that I'm going to ask for maybe 10% more, maybe 15%.
Now, in the public sector, those salaries are in the public domain.
In the public domain, salaries are
can look
published.
Those up.
Yes,
right.
You can.
But in private, they can be kept secret, and so the pay inequity can be exacerbated. Peggy, what if somebody feels they're being paid unfairly, that they are being discriminated against based on gender? Can they sue?
There is limited information available in the nonprofit sector. The 990 form does list the top salaries of nonprofits, so there is some ability to do some comparison shopping, if you will. But people in nonprofits are there because they love the cause. They're there to promote the mission, and it is not common to see people sue over things like pay inequity. It's happened, but it's not normal, if you will, Paul. And one thing in my 70 interviews that I did in our research shows that women will negotiate for salary before they join a nonprofit, but once they join the nonprofit, it becomes their family, and they are very reluctant to advocate for themselves. They will advocate for the organization. So, but the whole matter of suing or self-promotion is not something that is the way most of the people in nonprofits roll, and so I think it perpetuates some of this inequity that we are observing.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation. Let's go to Anna Marie in Pittsburgh, who's been waiting patient. Well, I spoke too soon. She's apparently is not there. But Anna Marie, if you want to get back on the phone with us, we would welcome your input into this conversation. We, of course, this issue was highlighted as recently as the Academy Awards ceremony. If you were watching at home, you might have seen Patricia Arquette as she accepted her Academy Award. Here's what she had to say.
To every woman who gave birth, to every taxpayer and citizen of this nation, we have fought for everybody else's equal rights. It's our time to have wage equality once and for all, and equal rights for women in the United States of America.
And again, that was Patricia Arquette at the Academy Awards. And Daria Crawley, you are one of the featured debaters tomorrow. Why is it important to look at this issue in Pittsburgh?
Well, you know, Pittsburgh has a large nonprofit community who is serving lots of our needs, whether it's arts, education, healthcare, et cetera. Why not pay our workers equitably? When we think about, I'm not a Pittsburgher, I'm originally from New York City, but when I think about Pittsburgh after living here almost 20 years, I think about this kind of blue-collar city, this friendly, family-oriented city. Don't we want equality for all? A union city, even more so, right. Don't we want equality for all? When we talk about issues of social injustice, now it's time for us to take a step back and look inside, for boards to look inside, board of directors and members, et cetera, to make it safe for someone to not, we're not demanding. When you demand, it seemed as aggressive, it seemed as negative. Instead, we want to begin the conversation so we can be on the pathway to pay equality.
How will this debate work tomorrow, Peggy?
Oh, gosh, it's going to be a terrific debate. It's going to be a presidential-style debate where we have five debaters. Daria, of course, is one of our distinguished debaters,
Thank
and we're
you.
So delighted that she is part of this conversation. Heather Arnay from the Women and Girls Foundation, Erin Mulchaney, who is the governor's representative in Southwest Pennsylvania, Dutch McDonald, who is the CEO at Maya Designs, and Ruth Ann Daly of the Post-Gazette are all coming with interesting and distinctive points of view to bring their own thoughts about how best to see that things get better and that more justice is done. Panina Lieber, a local attorney who specializes in nonprofit law, will be the moderator, so we will assure that it will be civil and on time. And then Grant Oliphant from the Heinz Endowments is our master of ceremonies. So we have really a wonderful lineup of community leaders who have thought deeply about why this issue matters and what we should do to change it.
412-246-2002, the number to call. We have a few minutes left for you to get into the conversation, and I do want to take some callers if we can. I'm sorry we didn't get to the lady who was holding earlier, but again, 412-246-2002, the number to call to weigh in. And Peggy, how has the Bayer Center for Nonprofit Management led this conversation on the importance of pay equity for nonprofits?
Right. That's our place to stand. We were very fortunate to receive a generous grant from the Eden Hall Foundation, as well as support from Bayer USA to fund our time and our attention on this. And I want to tell you one of the most fascinating things we learned. I have a young woman who works at the Bayer Center, Carrie Tancrater, who's now a doctoral candidate at Robert Morris University.
Wonderful.
And she did all our research. And I had the wit to ask her to look at the gender of the board chair, if the gender of the board chair made any difference in the way in which executives were paid. In southwestern Pennsylvania, there are 107 nonprofits that have annual operating budgets of $7 million or above. 75% of those jobs, the big jobs, are held by men, and 75% of the board chairs are men as well. If you are a man in one of those big nonprofits and you have a man as your board chair, it advantages you $90,000 a year on average over a woman in a similarly sized organization who has a woman as her board chair. So, Paul, this is not men versus women. This is not the classic, you know, feminist, whatever you want to say about being a feminist. This is a societal issue where we say, what is that about? Why are women board chairs not advancing the fair compensation for their women employees in the same way that a man does? I think men have a lot more confidence about a lot of things. And I can see, I've worked with over 1,000 nonprofits as my personal clients, that they stand in a meeting and they say, he's good. We've got to keep him. We need to pay him X. Whereas a woman sort of takes a vote around the room. How is everybody feeling about this? Is this the right thing? And does not assert herself in the same way that could result in a significant raise for her woman CEO in a nonprofit. So when we look at this issue, there's just fascinating threads to the whole thing. But boy, we sure do want to have a man as our board chair, because it really does make a difference in your pay.
And Daria, when do you think wages that women make will catch up with those of men?
Oh, my goodness. Of course, you're going to ask me that future-oriented question. Well, I'm thinking about it. You know, I actually am not sure. So I'm raising two young sons. My hope is that by time they enter the workforce and they move up their career ladders and become CEOs, you know, masters of industry here, that maybe at their point, you know, is that a generation away? It could be. I hate to say that it is that far off. My hope is that we can begin the trajectory upward. That's what I'd like to see.
Institute for Policy and Research says it's 47 years.
Okay, I wasn't that far off.
Ooh, that may not be in my lifetime. I don't know. Are there examples of companies that are leveling the playing field, businesses that are balancing out the pay inequity between men and women?
Yes, I understand from my friends in corporate America that just as you, Paul, people are fairly amazed that this is still an issue. And in corporate America, we are seeing real progress made. They have had deliberate women's committees in corporate America who have actively campaigned to see that jobs were given pay scales, not people given pay scales. Mm-hmm. And in government, you take a test to advance often in government. And so government has the greatest pay equity of any of the three sectors. And it's just ironic, isn't it, that it would be the nonprofit sector that would be lagging. But it is because we don't do HR well in nonprofit, and we have not given much attention to it. And so we're reaping the whirlwind for not having better HR.
How should the process be pushed along?
Well, I think, you know, the debate is one way. Opening eyes, giving people an opportunity to look at another perspective. So my hope is that those who attend tomorrow evening, you might walk in with one perspective. We're not necessarily going to change that, but hopefully we open your eyes. So when you sit on a board, when you work for a nonprofit, when you donate to a nonprofit, that these are some of the questions that you ask, that these are part of the investigation, the inquiry. So I'd love to start it there. As a professor, I'd love to start it in the classroom. So the individuals that I teach who will later on move into the corporate world, to the nonprofit sector, to the government sector, that their eyes are open when they have the opportunity to both be on the asking end and then on the giving end. So we are opening up eyes, encouraging people to ask questions, to figure out why, what is going on, and to really kind of think about and make a, I'd like us to make a stand in the sand and saying, here, you know what, do we want this to occur? If we do, what are the steps that I can individually take? What can I ask my organization to take?
May I say our next step is to write a book, Paul? We intend to bring all this research together. There was a book published in 1992 called Women in Power in the Nonprofit Sector, and to our knowledge, there has not been another book focused solely on this issue. There's lots of information about pay equity, but not in the nonprofit sector on this. So we are planning and intending to publish.
The great debate is taking place, the discussion about gender pay inequity or equity if you prefer, taking place tomorrow night at the 20th Century Club in Pittsburgh, a fundraiser for the 74% Initiative, which conducts research on women in the nonprofit sector. Peggy Morrison-Uten, Executive Director of the Bayer Center for Nonprofit Management at Robert Morris University, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And also Daria Crawley, Associate Professor of Management at Robert Morris University. By the way, it is the Bayer Center for Nonprofit Management at Robert Morris that is presenting the debate tomorrow. Daria Crawley, thank you for being
thank
here.
You.
You're one of the debaters. Good
I
luck.
Am. Thank you very much.
Coming up, our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, looks at the Pirates' home opener. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The Pirates' home opener, the retirement of Troy Polamalu, and what's next for the Penguins. All topics our sports guy, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus Bob Dvorak, is set to handle. He joins us by phone. Hi, Bob. It's a beautiful day for a ball game, is it not?
You could not ask for anything better, Paul. It's just a sign from the baseball gods.
It's supposed to rain later, though, so hopefully it won't go into extra innings. The Pirates and the Tigers today. The Pirates got off to a rough start, losing three in a row to the Reds. But then over the weekend, they took two out of three from the Brewers, a regular nemesis for the Pirates. And Milwaukee's always been a tough place for them to win. So what happened and what made the difference?
I think they learned in that Cincinnati series to have better at-bats. The strikeout rate was way too high. The weather was a factor. It was, a little bit of a rough start. But as you said, Milwaukee's always been a tough place to play. It was good to see the bats come alive yesterday, and a few long balls will solve a lot of problems.
There will be a big crowd. It's sold out at PNC Park today, as it usually is on opening day. And the Pirates are, again, playing the Tigers. But what will happen after this week, after people get used to the Pirates being back, to baseball being back? What kind of support do you see the Pirates getting?
I would not be surprised if they break another attendance record. I mean, just the excitement that I hear from fans, and if they win early, if they get off to a good start, I could see them breaking another attendance record. I really do. I think this city's really fallen back in love with its baseball team. And in that setting and with the weather, it's the place to be.
And you said, when you said that the city's fallen back in love with its baseball team, when the Steelers 5-6 years ago were winning Super Bowls and the Penguins won their most recent Stanley Cup, there were all sorts of T-shirts and things that were promoting that fact. One T-shirt that I can't quote directly on the radio for obvious reasons, but it said, "On the turf and on, or excuse me, on the ice and on the grass, our teams will kick your," and you can fill in the blank. But they were referring to the Steelers and the Penguins. But now, with the Steelers struggling and the Penguins seemingly on the downslide of the Crosby Malkin era, are the Pirates now the top, or at least the trendy sports draw in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I remember that one T-shirt, Paul. It said, We will, question mark, and with a Steeler logo, we did. It was that kind of thing. But they are. They positioned themselves to reestablish baseball as I don't know if it's a dominant sport, because the Steelers have such a big footprint in this town and always will. But when Mike Tomlin shows up at spring training, I think it catches people's eyes that, they've resumed their rightful place among the sports royalty in this town.
On to football. Steelers defensive back Troy Polamalu announced his retirement last week. What does it mean for him? What does it mean for the Steelers?
Well, there was only one Mean Joe Green. But in my mind, Troy Polamalu for his era was Mean Joe Green-like, in that he set the tone on that defense, and he was sort of like the face of the franchise, with the Tasmanian devil hair and such a meek, mild-mannered person off of it. You're going to miss him. He made a great contribution to this city. But I think last year they already saw that maybe some of those skills were declining, and they were trying to find a replacement. I don't know if they ever replace a guy like Troy, but they're going to have to. And they've got a new defensive coordinator. So, yeah, it's going to be a new look on defense for the Steelers.
You know, the timing seems about right, but, you know, that's never obvious to the athlete, to the person in question. In this case, Troy Polamalu, he seemed determined to continue playing, to not be rushed off the field. And then he ends up saying, okay, yep, I'm done. What do you suppose happened in the interim between the end of the season and last week's announcement?
Toughest decision an athlete has to make is when to leave the stage. And it's really difficult, especially when you've had so much success like he has. I think in talking to Coach Tomlin and Steeler ownership that, you know, what if he had been released? And then maybe even tried to catch on with another team like Tennessee. It just, I think it would have detracted from his standing here. You know, ex-Steelers in this town have a whole second life being exactly that, ex-Steelers, you know, with the restaurant business or car sponsorships or whatever. He'll always be a Steeler in this town, and I think that's his credit. And I think he's smart enough to know that the way he played the game takes a tremendous toll on the body, and I think he had lost maybe a half a step or a step. So he's really he's smart enough to know that it was time to leave.
And I tweeted out the answer to this question, so I'm sort of asking it rhetorically, but I'd like to hear your opinion. Would the Steelers have won their two most recent Super Bowls, both of which occurred with Troy Polamalu on the roster? Would the Steelers have been six-time Super Bowl champions without Troy Polamalu?
No, absolutely not. I know it helps to have a James Harrison, who was a defensive player of the year once, but Troy was a game changer. He could change a game on a single play, and he did so with enough frequency that, you know, you started to depend on him. Whether it was jumping over the line, recovering a fumble, intercepting a pass, returning it for a touchdown, the loudest roar I ever heard at Heinz Field was when he intercepted Flacco and scored the touchdown that put him in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, back in 2008, and they went on to beat the Cardinals in that Super Bowl, and certainly he had that look with the hair flowing out of the back of the helmet and flying as he went all over the place, as you called him, the Tasmanian Devil. So with the retirement of Troy Polamalu and Dick LeBeau moving on, are we seeing the end of an era in Pittsburgh football?
It's a transition for sure. It's the end of say the era of Polamalu at his height, yes, but sports is always in a transition. You know, there's players that come and go all the time. I thought when Hines Ward left that was the signal that was the beginning of a transition, and with Troy, pretty much, yeah, that this is going to be a new team this year, next year in a lot of ways.
Talking with our sports guy, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus Bob Dvorak. Bob, we have a few minutes to talk about the Penguins, who limped into the playoffs. They went on a skid to end their season and needed to win on the last day of the season to get into the playoffs, which they did. They beat Buffalo, which Sidney Crosby, the captain, says is momentum they can build on. But Buffalo is the worst team in the league. So now that the Penguins are in the prospects, what are in the playoffs, what prospects do they possibly have for winning the Stanley Cup?
Well, I would say, Paul, that there's probably less excitement and less expectations around this team in the playoffs than any time in the Sidney Crosby era. Yes, they got in, but the lineup is depleted. They're not at full strength, and they certainly weren't playing like a playoff team in the last 20 games or so. If they're to do anything, Marc-Andre Fleury is going to have to steal some games with just playing out of his mind. But you know what? That said, I'm kind of glad they're the underdog. They don't have home ice advantage. The pressure's not on them. Pressure's going to be on some other teams. But that opening round against the Rangers, with the best record in the conference, and that's the team that knocked them out last year. So, everybody thinks they're going to be just one series and they're out, but who knows? It's the playoffs.
Okay, and we're down to 1 minute, but the Penguins seem to be on the downside of this great era of Crosby and Evgeny Malkin and the goalie Marc-Andre Fleury. If that is the case, there's speculation that there may be an ownership change. What do you see there?
I don't know. It's hard to say. Everybody expects the bottom to fall out, but maybe they didn't have the best supporting cast around Crosby and Malkin, Fleury, Letang. That's their core. They've got to be smarter, adding some auxiliary players. So it doesn't take much to add a couple of free agents and have some draft picks come up, and they could pick it right up. So no, I don't see. I couldn't even see Mario getting out. Ron Burkle, I don't know. That's speculation, but he certainly doesn't need the money, that's for sure. So I think they like where they are, and they'll be fine.
Our sports guy, Bob Dvorak, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports writer emeritus. Bob, as always, a pleasure visiting with you. Thank you so much.
And they say play ball, not work ball, Paul.
Right. Thanks for that reminder, Bob.
Yeah,
thank you for
bet.
Listening to Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We'll see you tomorrow on 90.5 WESA.